This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Big Sleep, written by Raymond Chandler, performed by Ray Porter.
1. It was about 11 o'clock in the morning, mid-October, with the sun not shining and a look of hard, wet rain in the clearness of the foothills. I was wearing my powder blue suit with dark blue shirt, tie and display handkerchief, black brogues, black wool socks with dark blue clocks on them. I was neat, clean, shaved and sober, and I didn't care who knew it. I was everything the well-dressed private detective ought to be. I was calling on $4 million. The main hallway of the Sternwood place was 2 stories high. Over the entrance doors, which would have let in a troop of Indian elephants, there was a broad stained glass panel showing a knight in dark armor rescuing a lady who was tied to a tree and didn't have any clothes on but some very long and convenient hair. The knight had pushed the visor of his helmet back to be sociable, and he was fiddling with the knots on the ropes that tied the lady to the tree and not getting anywhere. I stood there and thought that if I lived in the house, I would sooner or later have to climb up there and help him. He didn't seem to be really trying. There were French doors at the back of the hall, beyond them a wide sweep of emerald grass to a white garage, in front of which a slim, dark young chauffeur in shiny black leggings was dusting a maroon Packard convertible. Beyond the garage were some decorative trees trimmed as carefully as poodle dogs. Beyond them a large greenhouse with a domed roof. Then more trees, and beyond everything the solid, uneven, comfortable line of the foothills. On the east side of the hall, a free staircase, tile-paved, rose to a gallery with a wrought-iron railing and another piece of stained-glass romance. Large hard chairs with rounded red plush seats were backed into the vacant spaces of the wall roundabout. They didn't look as if anybody had ever sat in them. In the middle of the west wall, there was a big empty fireplace with a brass screen and 4 hinged panels, and over the fireplace a marble mantel with cupids at the corners. Above the mantel there was a large oil portrait, and above the portrait 2 bullet-torn or moth-eaten cavalry pennants crossed in a glass frame. The portrait was a stiffly posed job of an officer in full regimentals of about the time of the Mexican War. The officer had a neat black imperial, black mustachios, hot, hard, coal-black eyes, and the general look of a man it would pay to get along with. I thought this might be General Sternwood's grandfather. It could hardly be the general himself, even though I had heard he was pretty far gone in years to have a couple of daughters still in the dangerous 20s. I was still staring at the hot black eyes when a door opened far back under the stairs. It wasn't the butler coming back. It was a girl. She was 20 or so, small and delicately put together, but she looked durable. She wore pale blue slacks, and they looked well on her. She walked as if she were floating. Her hair was a fine, tawny wave cut much shorter than the current fashion of page-boy tresses curled in at the bottoms. Her eyes were slate-gray and had almost no expression when they looked at me. She came over near me and smiled with her mouth, and she had little, sharp, predatory teeth, as white as fresh orange pith and as shiny as porcelain. They glistened between her thin, too taut lips. Her face lacked color and didn't look too healthy.
"Tall, aren't you?"
she said. I didn't mean to be. Her eyes rounded. She was puzzled. She was thinking, I could see, even on that short acquaintance, that thinking was always going to be a bother to her.
"Handsome, too,"
she said.
"And I bet you know it."
I grunted.
"What's your name?"
"Riley," I said. "Doghouse Riley."
"That's a funny name."
She bit her lip and turned her head a little and looked at me along her eyes. Then she lowered her lashes until they almost cuddled her cheeks and slowly raised them again like a theater curtain. I was to get to know that trick. That was supposed to make me roll over on my back with all 4 paws in the air.
"Are you a prize fighter?"
she asked when I didn't. "Not exactly. I'm a sleuth." She tossed her head angrily, and the rich color of it glistened in the rather dim light of the big hall.
"You're making fun of me."
"Uh-uh."
"What?"
"Get on with you," I said. "You heard me.
You didn't say anything. You're just a big tease.
She put a thumb up and bit it. It was a curiously shaped thumb, thin and narrow like an extra finger with no curve in the first joint. She bit it and sucked it slowly, turning it around in her mouth like a baby with a comforter.
You're awfully tall,
she said, and she giggled with secret merriment. Then she turned her body slowly and lithely without lifting her feet. Her hands dropped limp at her sides. She tilted herself toward me on her toes. She fell straight back into my arms. I had to catch her or let her crack her head on the tessellated floor. I caught her under her arms, and she went rubber-legged on me instantly. I had to hold her close to hold her up. When her head was against my chest, she screwed it around and giggled at me.
You're cute,
she giggled.
I'm cute, too.
I didn't say anything. So the butler chose that convenient moment to come back through the French doors and see me holding her. It didn't seem to bother him. He was a tall, thin, silver man, 60 or close to it, or a little past it. He had blue eyes, as remote as eyes could be. His skin was smooth and bright, and he moved like a man with very sound muscles. He walked slowly across the floor toward us, and the girl jerked away from me. She flashed across the room to the foot of the stairs and went up them like a deer. She was gone before I could draw a long breath and let it out. The butler said tonelessly,
"The general will see you now, Mr. Marlowe."
I pushed my lower jaw up off my chest and nodded at him. "Who was that?"
"Miss Carmen Sternwood, sir."
"You ought to wean her. She looks old enough." He looked at me with grave politeness and repeated what he had said. 2. We went out at the French doors and along a smooth red-flagged path that skirted the far side of the lawn from the garage. The boyish-looking chauffeur had a big black and chromium sedan out now and was dusting that. The path took us along to the side of the greenhouse, and the butler opened a door for me and stood aside. It opened into a sort of vestibule that was about as warm as a slow oven. He came in after me, shut the outer door, opened an inner door, and we went through that. Then it was really hot. The air was thick, wet, steamy, and larded with the cloying smell of tropical orchids in bloom. The glass walls and roof were heavily misted, and big drops of moisture splashed down on the plants. The light had an unreal greenish color, like light filtered through an aquarium tank. The plants filled the place, a forest of them, with nasty, meaty leaves and stalks like the newly washed fingers of dead men. They smelled as overpowering as boiling alcohol under a blanket. The butler did his best to get me through without being smacked in the face by the sudden leaves, and after a while we came to a clearing in the middle of the jungle, under the domed roof. Here, in a space of hexagonal flags, an old red Turkish rug was laid down, and on the rug was a wheelchair. And in the wheelchair, an old and obviously dying man watched us come with black eyes from which all fire had died long ago, but which still had the cold black directness of the eyes in the portrait that hung above the mantel in the hall. The rest of his face was a leaden mask, with the bloodless lips and the sharp nose and the sunken temples and the outward-turning earlobes of approaching dissolution. His long, narrow body was wrapped in that heat, in a traveling rug and a faded red bathrobe. His thin, claw-like hands were folded loosely on the rug, purple-nailed. A few locks of dry white hair clung to his scalp like wildflowers fighting for life on a bare rock. The butler stood in front of him and said,
"This is Mr. Marlowe, General."
The old man didn't move or speak, or even nod. He just looked at me, lifelessly. The butler pushed a damp wicker chair against the backs of my legs, and I sat down. He took my hat with a deft scoop. Then the old man dragged his voice up from the bottom of a well and said,
"Brandy, Norris. How do you like your brandy, sir?"
"Any way at all," I said. The butler went away among the abominable plants. The general spoke again, slowly, using his strength as carefully as an out-of-work showgirl uses her last good pair of stockings.
"I used to like mine with champagne. The champagne is cold as Valley Forge, and about a third of a glass of brandy beneath it. You may take your coat off, sir. It's too hot in here for a man with blood in his veins.
I stood up and peeled off my coat and got a handkerchief out and mopped my face and neck and the backs of my wrists. St. Louis in August had nothing on that place. I sat down again and felt automatically for a cigarette, and then stopped. The old man caught the gesture and smiled faintly.
You may smoke, sir. I like the smell of tobacco.
I lit the cigarette and blew a lungful at him, and he sniffed at it, like a terrier at a rat hole. The faint smile pulled at the shadowed corners of his mouth.
A nice state of affairs when a man has to indulge his vices by proxy,
he said dryly.
You are looking at a very dull survival of a rather gaudy life. A cripple paralyzed in both legs and with only half of his lower belly. There's very little that I can eat, and my sleep is so close to waking that it is hardly worth the name. I seem to exist largely on heat, like a newborn spider, and the orchids are an excuse for the heat. Do you like orchids?
Not particularly, I said. The general half closed his eyes.
They are nasty things. Their flesh is too much like the flesh of men, and their perfume has the rotten sweetness of a prostitute.
I stared at him with my mouth open. The soft, wet heat was like a pall around us. The old man nodded, as if his neck was afraid of the weight of his head. Then the butler came pushing back through the jungle with a tea wagon, mixed me a brandy and soda, swathed the copper ice bucket with a damp napkin, and went softly away among the orchids. A door opened and shut behind the jungle. I sipped the drink. The old man licked his lips, watching me, over and over again, drawing one lip slowly across the other with funereal absorption, like an undertaker dry-washing his hands.
Tell me about yourself, Mr. Marlowe. I suppose I have a right to ask.
Sure, but there's very little to tell. I'm 33 years old, went to college once, and can still speak English if there's any demand for it. There isn't much in my trade. I worked for Mr. Wilde, the district attorney, as an investigator once. His chief investigator, a man named Bernie Oles, called me and told me you wanted to see me. I'm unmarried because I don't like policemen's wives.
And a little bit of a cynic.
The old man smiled.
You didn't like working for Wilde.
I was fired. For insubordination. I test very high on insubordination, General.
I always did myself, sir. I'm glad to hear it. What do you know about my family?
I'm told you are a widower and have two young daughters, both pretty and both wild. One of them has been married three times, the last time to an ex-bootlegger who went in the trade by the name of Rusty Regan. That's all I heard, General.
Did any of it strike you as peculiar?
The Rusty Regan part, maybe, but I always got along with bootleggers myself. He smiled his faint, economical smile.
It seems I do, too. I'm very fond of Rusty. A big, curly-headed Irishman from Clonmel, with sad eyes and a smile as wide as Wilshire Boulevard. The first time I saw him, I thought he might be what you are probably thinking he was, an adventurer who happened to get himself wrapped up in some velvet.
You must have liked him, I said. You learned to talk the language. He put his thin, bloodless hands under the edge of the rug. I put my cigarette stub out and finished my drink.
He was the breath of life to me while he lasted. He spent hours with me, sweating like a pig, drinking brandy by the quart and telling me stories of the Irish Revolution. He had been an officer in the IRA. He wasn't even legally in the United States. It was a ridiculous marriage, of course, and it probably didn't last a month as a marriage. I'm telling you the family secrets, Mr. Marlowe.
They're still secrets, I said. What happened to him? The old man looked at me woodenly.
He went away a month ago. Abruptly. Without a word to anyone. Without saying goodbye to me. That hurt a little, but he had been raised in a rough school. I'll hear from him one of these days. Meantime, I am being blackmailed again.
I said, again? He brought his hands from under the rug with a brown envelope in them.
I should have been very sorry for anybody who tried to blackmail me while Rusty was around. A few months before he came, that is to say, about 9 or 10 months ago, I paid a man named Joe Brody $5,000 to let my younger daughter Carmen alone.
Ah, I said. He moved his thin white eyebrows.
That means what?
Nothing, I said. He went on staring at me, half frowning. Then he said,
take this envelope and examine it, and help yourself to the brandy.
I took the envelope off his knees and sat down with it again. I wiped off the palms of my hands and turned it around. It was addressed to General Guy Sternwood, 3765 Altabrea Crescent, West Hollywood, California. The address was in ink, in the slanting printing engineers use. The envelope was slit. I opened it up and took out a brown card and three slips of stiff paper. The card was of thin brown linen, printed in gold. Mr. Arthur Gwynne Geiger. No address. Very small in the lower left-hand corner. Rare books and deluxe editions. I turned the card over. More of the slanted printing on the back. Dear Sir, in spite of the legal uncollectability of the enclosed, which frankly represent gambling debts, I assume you might wish them honored. Respectfully, A.G. Geiger. I looked at the slips of stiffish white paper. They were promissory notes, filled out in ink, dated on several dates early in the month before, September. On demand, I promise to pay to Arthur Gwynne Geiger or order the sum of $1,000 without interest, value received. Carmen Sternwood. The written part was in a sprawling, moronic handwriting with a lot of fat curlicues and circles for dots. I mixed myself another drink and sipped it and put the exhibit aside.
Your conclusions?
The general asked. I haven't any yet. Who is this Arthur Gwynne Geiger?
I haven't the faintest idea.
What does Carmen say?
I haven't asked her. I don't intend to. If I did, she would suck a thumb and look coy.
I said, I met her in the hall. She did that to me. Then she tried to sit in my lap. Nothing changed in his expression. His clasped hands rested peacefully on the edge of the rug, and the heat, which made me feel like a New England boiled dinner, didn't seem to make him even warm. Do I have to be polite? I asked, or can I just be natural?
I haven't noticed that you suffer from many inhibitions, Mr. Marlowe.
Do the two girls run around together?
I think not. I think they go their separate and slightly divergent roads to perdition. Vivian is spoiled, exacting, smart, and quite ruthless. Carmen is a child who likes to pull wings off flies. Neither of them has any more moral sense than a cat. Neither have I. No Sternwood ever had. Proceed.
They're well-educated, I suppose. They know what they're doing.
Vivian went to good schools of the snob type and to college. Carmen went to half a dozen schools of greater and greater liberality and ended up where she started. I presume they both had and still have all the usual vices. If I sound a little sinister as a parent, Mr. Marlowe, it is because my hold on life is too slight to include any Victorian hypocrisy.
He leaned his head back and closed his eyes, then opened them again suddenly.
I need not add that a man who indulges in parenthood for the first time at the age of 54 deserves all he gets.
I sipped my drink and nodded. The pulse in his lean gray throat throbbed visibly and yet so slowly that it was hardly a pulse at all. An old man two-thirds dead and still determined to believe he could take it.
Your conclusions?
He asked suddenly. I'd pay him.
Why?
It's a question of a little money against a lot of annoyance. There has to be something behind it, but nobody's going to break your heart if it hasn't been done already. And it would take an awful lot of chiselers, an awful lot of time to rob you of enough so that you'd even notice it.
I have pride, sir,
he said coldly. Somebody's counting on that. It's the easiest way to fool them, that of the police. Geiger can collect on these notes, unless you can show fraud. Instead of that, he makes you a present of them and admits they are gambling debts, which gives you a defense, even if he had kept the notes. If he's a crook, he knows his onions. And if he's an honest man doing a little loan business on the side, he ought to have his money. Who was this Joe Brody you paid the $5,000 to?
Some kind of gambler. I hardly recall. Norris would know, my butler.
Your daughters have the money in their own right, General?
Vivian has, but not a great deal. Carmen is still a minor under her mother's will. I give them both generous allowances.
I said, I can take this Geiger off your back, General, if that's what you want. Whoever he is and whatever he has, it may cost you a little money, besides what you pay me. And, of course, it won't get you anything. Sugaring them never does. You're already listed on their book of nice names.
I see.
He shrugged his wide, sharp shoulders in the faded red bathrobe.
A moment ago you said pay him. Now you say it won't get me anything.
I mean, it might be cheaper and easier to stand for a certain amount of squeeze, that's all.
I'm afraid I'm rather an impatient man, Mr. Marlowe. What are your charges?
I get 25 a day and expenses, when I'm lucky.
I see. It seems reasonable enough for removing morbid growths from people's backs. Quite a delicate operation. You realize that, I hope. You'll make your operation as little of a shock to the patient as possible. There might be several of them, Mr. Marlowe.
I finished my second drink and wiped my lips and my face. The heat didn't get any less hot with the brandy in me. The general blinked at me and plucked at the edge of his rug. Can I make a deal with this guy, if I think he's within hooting distance of being on the level?
Yes, the matter is now in your hands. I never do things by halves.
I'll take him out, I said. He'll think a bridge fell on him.
I'm sure you will. And now I must excuse myself. I am tired.
He reached out and touched the bell on the arm of his chair. The cord was plugged into a black cable that wound along the side of the deep, dark green boxes in which the orchids grew and festered. He closed his eyes, opened them again in a brief, bright stare, and settled back among his cushions. The lids dropped again, and he didn't pay any more attention to me. I stood up and lifted my coat off the back of the damp wicker chair and went off with it among the orchids, opened the two doors and stood outside in the brisk October air, getting myself some oxygen. The chauffeur over by the garage had gone away. The butler came along the red path with smooth, light steps and his back as straight as an ironing board. I shrugged into my coat and watched him come. He stopped about 2 feet from me and said gravely,
"Mrs. Regan would like to see you before you leave, sir. And in the matter of money, the general has instructed me to give you a check for whatever seems desirable."
"Instructed you how?" He looked puzzled, then he smiled.
"Ah, I see, sir. You are, of course, a detective. By the way, he rang his bell."
"You write his checks?"
"I have that privilege."
"That ought to save you from a pauper's grave. No money now, thanks. What does Mrs. Regan want to see me about?" His blue eyes gave me a smooth, level look.
"She has a misconception of the purpose of your visit, sir."
"Who told her anything about my visit?"
"Her windows command the greenhouse. She saw us go in. I was obliged to tell her who you were."
"I don't like that," I said. His blue eyes frosted.
"Are you attempting to tell me my duties, sir?"
"No. But I'm having a lot of fun trying to guess what they are." We stared at each other for a moment. He gave me a blue glare and turned away. 3. This room was too big. The ceiling was too high. The doors were too tall, and the white carpet that went from wall to wall looked like a fresh fall of snow at Lake Arrowhead. There were full-length mirrors and crystal doodads all over the place. The ivory furniture had chromium on it, and the enormous ivory drapes lay tumbled on the white carpet a yard from the windows. The white made the ivory look dirty, and the ivory made the white look bled out. The windows stared toward the darkening foothills. It was going to rain soon. There was pressure in the air already. I sat down on the edge of a deep, soft chair and looked at Mrs. Regan. She was worth a stare. She was trouble. She was stretched out on a modernistic chaise longue with her slippers off, so I stared at her legs in the sheerest silk stockings. They seemed to be arranged to stare at. They were visible to the knee and one of them well beyond. The knees were dimpled, not bony and sharp. The calves were beautiful, the ankles long and slim and with enough melodic line for a tone poem. She was tall and rangy and strong-looking. Her head was against an ivory satin cushion. Her hair was black and wiry and parted in the middle, and she had the hot black eyes of the portrait in the hall. She had a good mouth and a good chin. There was a sulky droop to her lips, and the lower lip was full. She had a drink. She took a swallow from it and gave me a cool, level stare over the rim of the glass.
"So you're a private detective,"
she said.
"I didn't know they really existed, except in books, or else they were greasy little men snooping around hotels."
There was nothing in that for me, so I let it drift with the current. She put her glass down on the flat arm of the chaise lounge and flashed an emerald and touched her hair. She said slowly,
"How did you like Dad?"
"I liked him," I said.
"He liked Rusty. I suppose you know who Rusty is?"
"Uh-huh."
"Rusty was earthy and vulgar at times, but he was very real, and he was a lot of fun for Dad. Rusty shouldn't have gone off like that. Dad feels very badly about it, although he won't say so. Or did he?"
"He said something about it."
"You're not much of a gusher, are you, Mr. Marlowe? But he wants to find him, doesn't he?"
I stared at her, politely through a pause. "Yes and no," I said.
"That's hardly an answer. Do you think you can find him?"
"I didn't say I was going to try. When I try the Missing Persons Bureau, they have the organization. It's not a one-man job."
"Oh, Dad wouldn't hear of the police being brought into it."
She looked at me smoothly across her glass again, emptied it, and rang a bell. A maid came into the room by a side door. She was a middle-aged woman with a long, yellow, gentle face, a long nose, no chin, large wet eyes. She looked like a nice old horse that had been turned out to pasture after long service. Mrs. Regan waved the empty glass at her, and she mixed another drink and handed it to her and left the room, without a word, without a glance in my direction. When the door shut, Mrs. Regan said,
"Well, how will you go about it, then?"
"How and when did he skip out?"
"Didn't Dad tell you?"
I grinned at her with my head on one side. She flushed. Her hot black eyes looked mad.
"I don't see what there is to be cagey about,"
she snapped.
"And I don't like your manners."
"I'm not crazy about yours," I said. "I didn't ask to see you. You sent for me. I don't mind your ritzing me or drinking your lunch out of a scotch bottle. I don't mind your showing me your legs. They're very swell legs, and it's a pleasure to make their acquaintance. I don't mind if you don't like my manners. They're pretty bad. I grieve over them during the long winter evenings. But don't waste your time trying to cross-examine me." She slammed her glass down so hard that it slopped over on an ivory cushion. She swung her legs to the floor and stood up with her eyes sparking fire and her nostrils wide. Her mouth was open and her bright teeth glared at me. Her knuckles were white.
"People don't talk like that to me," she said thickly.
I sat there and grinned at her. Very slowly she closed her mouth and looked down at the spilled liquor. She sat down on the edge of the chaise lounge and cupped her chin in one hand.
"My God, you big, dark, handsome brute, I ought to throw a Buick at you."
I snicked a match on my thumbnail, and for once it lit. I puffed smoke into the air and waited.
"I loathe masterful men,"
she said.
"I simply loathe them."
"Just what is it you're afraid of, Mrs. Regan?" Her eyes whitened. Then they darkened until they seemed to be all pupil. Her nostrils looked pinched.
"That wasn't what he wanted with you at all,"
she said in a strained voice that still had shreds of anger clinging to it.
"About Rusty, was it?"
"Better ask him." She flared up again.
"Get out! Damn you, get out!"
I stood up.
"Sit down,"
she snapped. I sat down. I flicked a finger at my palm and waited.
"Please,"
she said.
"Please. You could find Rusty if Dad wanted you to."
That didn't work either. I nodded and asked, "When did he go?"
"One afternoon, a month back. He just drove away in his car without saying a word. They found the car in a private garage somewhere."
"They?" She got cunning. Her whole body seemed to go lax. Then she smiled at me winningly.
"He didn't tell you then."
Her voice was almost gleeful, as if she had outsmarted me. Maybe she had. He told me about Mr. Regan, yes. That's not what he wanted to see me about. Is that what you've been trying to get me to say?
I'm sure I don't care what you say.
I stood up again. Then I'll be running along. She didn't speak. I went over to the tall white door I had come in at. When I looked back, she had her lip between her teeth and was worrying it like a puppy at the fringe of a rug. I went out, down the tile staircase to the hall, and the butler drifted out of somewhere with my hat in his hand. I put it on while he opened the door for me. "You made a mistake," I said. "Mrs. Regan didn't want to see me." He inclined his silver head and said politely,
"I'm sorry, sir, I make many mistakes."
He closed the door against my back. I stood on the step, breathing my cigarette smoke and looking down a succession of terraces with flower beds and trimmed trees to the high iron fence with gilt spears that hemmed in the estate. A winding driveway dropped down between retaining walls to the open iron gates. Beyond the fence, the hill sloped for several miles. On this lower level, faint and far off, I could just barely see some of the old wooden derricks of the oil field from which the Sternwoods had made their money. Most of the field was public park now, cleaned up and donated to the city by General Sternwood, but a little of it was still producing in groups of wells pumping 5 or 6 barrels a day. The Sternwoods, having moved up the hill, could no longer smell the stale sump water or the oil, but they could still look out of their front windows and see what had made them rich. If they wanted to. I don't suppose they would want to. I walked down a brick path from terrace to terrace, followed along inside the fence and so out of the gates to where I had left my car under a pepper tree on the street. Thunder was crackling in the foothills now, and the sky above them was purple-black. It was going to rain, hard. The air had the damp foretaste of rain. I put the top up on my convertible before I started downtown. She had lovely legs. I would say that for her. They were a couple of pretty smooth citizens, she and her father. He was probably just trying me out. The job he had given me was a lawyer's job. Even if Mr. Arthur Gwynne Geiger, Rare Books and Deluxe Editions, turned out to be a blackmailer, it was still a lawyer's job. Unless there was a lot more to it than met the eye. At a casual glance, I thought I might have a lot of fun finding out. I drove down to the Hollywood Public Library and did a little superficial research in a stuffy volume called Famous First Editions. Half an hour of it made me need my lunch. 4. A.G. Geiger's place was a store frontage on the north side of the boulevard near Las Palmas. The entrance door was set far back in the middle, and there was a copper trim on the windows, which were backed with Chinese screens, so I couldn't see into the store. There was a lot of Oriental junk in the windows. I don't know whether it was any good, not being a collector of antiques, except unpaid bills. The entrance door was plate glass, but I couldn't see much through that either, because the store was very dim. A building entrance adjoined it on one side, and on the other was a glittering credit jewelry establishment. The jeweler stood in his entrance, teetering on his heels and looking bored. A tall, handsome, white-haired Jew in lean, dark clothes with about 9 carats of diamond on his right hand. A faint, knowing smile curved his lips when I turned into Geiger's store. I let the door close softly behind me and walked on a thick blue rug that paved the floor from wall to wall. There were blue leather easy chairs with smoke stands beside them. A few sets of tooled leather bindings were set out on narrow polished tables between bookends. There were more tooled bindings and glass cases on the walls. Nice-looking merchandise, the kind a rich promoter would buy by the yard and have somebody paste his bookplate in. At the back there was a grained wood partition with a door in the middle of it, shut. In the corner, made by the partition and one wall, a woman sat behind a small desk with a carved wooden lantern on it. She got up slowly and swayed towards me in a tight black dress that didn't reflect any light. She had long thighs, and she walked with a certain something I hadn't often seen in bookstores. She was an ash blonde with greenish eyes, beaded lashes, hair waved smoothly back from ears in which large jet buttons glittered. Her fingernails were silvered. In spite of her get-up, she looked as if she would have a hall-bedroom accent. She approached me with enough sex appeal to stampede a businessman's lunch and tilted her head to finger a stray, but not very stray, tendril of softly glowing hair. Her smile was tentative, but could be persuaded to be nice.
"Was it something?"
she inquired. I had my horn-rimmed sunglasses on. I put my voice high and let a bird twitter in it.
"Would you happen to have a Ben-Hur 1860?
She didn't say, "Huh?" but she wanted to. She smiled bleakly.
"A first edition?"
"Third,"
I said.
"The one with the erratum on page 116.
"I am afraid not, at the moment."
"How about a Chevalier Audubon 1840? The full set, of course."
Not at the moment,"
she said harshly. Her smile was now hanging by its teeth and eyebrows and wondering what it would hit when it dropped.
"You do sell books,"
I said in my polite falsetto. She looked me over. No smile now. Eyes medium to hard, posed very straight and stiff. She waved silver fingernails at the glassed-in shelves.
"What do they look like? Grapefruit?"
she inquired tartly.
"Oh, that sort of thing hardly interests me, you know. Probably has duplicate sets of steel engravings, tuppence colored and a penny plain. The usual vulgarity. No, I'm sorry. No."
"I see."
She tried to jack the smile back upon her face. She was as sore as an alderman with the mumps.
"Perhaps Mr. Geiger, but he's not in at the moment."
Her eyes studied me carefully. She knew as much about rare books as I knew about handling a flea circus.
"He might be in later."
"I'm afraid not until late."
"Too bad,"
I said.
"Ah, too bad. I'll sit down and smoke a cigarette in one of these charming chairs. I have rather a blank afternoon, nothing to think about but my trigonometry lesson."
"Yes,"
she said.
"Yes, of course."
I stretched out in one and lit a cigarette with the round nickel lighter on the smoking stand. She still stood, holding her lower lip with her teeth, her eyes vaguely troubled. She nodded at last, turned slowly, and walked back to her little desk in the corner. From behind the lamp, she stared at me. I crossed my ankles and yawned. Her silver nails went out to the cradle phone on the desk, didn't touch it, dropped, and began to tap on the desk. Silence for about 5 minutes. The door opened, and a tall, hungry-looking bird with a cane and a big nose came in neatly, shut the door behind him against the pressure of the door closer, marched over to the desk and placed a wrapped parcel on the desk. He took a pin-seal wallet with gold corners from his pocket and showed the blonde something. She pressed a button on the desk. The tall bird went to the door and the paneled partition and opened it barely enough to slip through. I finished my cigarette and lit another. The minutes dragged by. Horns tooted and grunted on the boulevard. A big red interurban car grumbled past. A traffic light gonged. The blonde leaned on her elbow and cupped a hand over her eyes and stared at me behind it. The partition door opened and the tall bird with the cane slid out. He had another wrapped parcel, the shape of a large book. He went over to the desk and paid money. He left as he had come, walking on the balls of his feet, breathing with his mouth open, giving me a sharp side glance as he passed. I got to my feet, tipped my hat to the blonde, and went out after him. He walked west, swinging his cane in a small, tight arc just above his right shoe. He was easy to follow. His coat was cut from a rather loud piece of horse robe with shoulders so wide that his neck stuck up out of it like a celery stalk, and his head wobbled on it as he walked. He went a block and a half. At the Highland Avenue traffic signal, I pulled up beside him and let him see me. He gave me a casual, then a suddenly sharpened side glance and quickly turned away. We crossed Highland with the green light and made another block. He stretched his long legs and had 20 yards on me at the corner. He turned right, 100 feet up the hill, and stopped and hooked his cane over his arm and fumbled a leather cigarette case out of an inner pocket. He put his cigarette in his mouth, dropped his match, looked back when he picked it up, saw me watching him from the corner and straightened up as if somebody had booted him from behind. He almost raised dust going up the block, walking with long, gawky strides and jabbing his cane into the pavement. He turned left again. He had at least half a block on me when I reached the place where he had turned. He had me wheezing. This was a narrow, tree-lined street with a retaining wall on one side and three bungalow courts on the other. He was gone. I loafed along the block, peering this way and that. At the second bungalow court, I saw something. It was called the La Baba, a quiet, dim place with a double row of tree-shaded bungalows. The central walk was lined with Italian cypresses trimmed short and chunky, something the shape of the oil jars in Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves. Behind the third jar, a loud-patterned sleeve edge moved. I leaned against a pepper tree in the parkway and waited. The thunder in the foothills was rumbling again. The glare of lightning was reflected on piled-up black clouds off to the south. A few tentative raindrops splashed down on the pavement and made spots as large as nickels. The air was as still as the air in General Sternwood's orchid house. The sleeve behind the tree showed again, then a big nose and one eye and some sandy hair without a hat on it. The eye stared at me. It disappeared. Its mate reappeared like a woodpecker on the other side of the tree. 5 minutes went by. It got him. His type are half nerves. I heard a match strike and then whistling started. Then a dim shadow slipped along the grass to the next tree. Then he was out on the walk coming straight towards me, swinging the cane and whistling. A sour whistle with jitters in it. I stared vaguely up at the dark sky. He passed within 10 feet of me and didn't give me a glance. He was safe now. He had ditched it. I watched him, out of sight, and went up the central walk of the La Baba and parted the branches of the third cypress. I drew out a wrapped book and put it under my arm and went away from there. Nobody yelled at me. 5. Back on the boulevard, I went into a drugstore phone booth and looked up Mr. Arthur Gwynn Geiger's residence. He lived on Laverne Terrace, a hillside street off Laurel Canyon Boulevard. I dropped my nickel and dialed his number, just for fun. Nobody answered. I turned to the classified section and noted a couple of bookstores within blocks of where I was. The first I came to was on the north side, a large lower floor devoted to stationery and office supplies, a mass of books on the mezzanine. It didn't look the right place. I crossed the street and walked 2 blocks east to the other one. This was more like it. A narrowed, cluttered little shop stacked with books from floor to ceiling and 4 or 5 browsers taking their time putting thumb marks on the new jackets. Nobody paid any attention to them. I shoved on back into the store, passed through a partition and found a small, dark woman reading a law book at a desk. I flipped my wallet open on her desk and let her look at the buzzer pinned to the flap. She looked at it, took her glasses off, and leaned back in her chair. I put the wallet away. She had the fine, drawn face of an intelligent Jewess. She stared at me and said nothing. I said, "Would you do me a favor? A very small favor."
"I don't know. What is it?"
She had a smoothly husky voice. "You know Geiger's store across the street, 2 blocks west?"
"I think I may have passed it."
"It's a bookstore," I said. "Not your kind of bookstore. You know darn well." She curled her lips slightly and said nothing. "You know Geiger by sight?" I asked.
"I'm sorry, I don't know, Mr. Geiger."
"Then you couldn't tell me what he looks like?" Her lip curled some more.
"Why should I?"
"No reason at all. If you don't want to, I can't make you." She looked out through the partition door and leaned back again.
"That was the sheriff's star, wasn't it?"
"Honorary deputy. Doesn't mean a thing. It's worth a dime cigar."
"I see."
She reached for a pack of cigarettes and shook one loose and reached for it with her lips. I held a match for her. She thanked me, leaned back again, and regarded me through smoke. She said carefully,
"You wish to know what he looks like and you don't want to interview him."
"He's not there," I said.
"I presume he will be. After all, it's his store."
"I don't want to interview him just yet," I said. She looked out through the open doorway again. I said, "Know anything about rare books?"
"You could try me."
"Would you have a Ben-Hur 1860 third edition, the one with the duplicated line on page 116? She pushed her yellow law book to one side and reached a fat volume up on the desk, leafed it through, found her page, and studied it.
"Nobody would,"
she said without looking up.
"There isn't one."
"Right."
"What in the world are you driving at?"
The girl in Geiger's store didn't know that. She looked up.
I see. You interest me rather vaguely.
I'm a private dick on a case. Perhaps I asked too much. It didn't seem much to me somehow. She blew a soft, gray smoke ring and poked her finger through. It came to pieces in frail wisps. She spoke smoothly, indifferently.
In his early 40s, I should judge. Medium height, fattish, would weigh about 160 pounds. Fat face, Charlie Chan mustache, thick, soft neck. Soft all over. Well-dressed. Goes without a hat. Affects a knowledge of antiques and hasn't any. Oh, yes, his left eye is glass.
You'd make a good cop, I said. She put the reference book back on an open shelf at the end of her desk and opened the law book in front of her again.
I hope not, she said.
She put her glasses on. I thanked her and left. The rain had started. I ran for it, with the wrapped book under my arm. My car was on a side street pointing at the boulevard almost opposite Geiger's store. I was well sprinkled before I got there. I tumbled into the car and ran both windows up and wiped my parcel off with my handkerchief. Then I opened it up. I knew about what it would be, of course. A heavy book, well-bound, handsomely printed in handset type on fine paper, larded with full-page, arty photographs. Photos and letterpress were alike of an indescribable filth. The book was not new. Dates were stamped on the front-end paper, in- and out-dates. A rent book. A lending library of elaborate smut. I rewrapped the book and locked it up behind the seat. A racket like that, out in the open on the boulevard, seemed to mean plenty of protection. I sat there and poisoned myself with cigarette smoke and listened to the rain and thought about it. 6. Rain filled the gutters and splashed knee-high off the pavement. Big cops in slickers that shone like gun barrels had a lot of fun carrying giggling girls across the bad places. The rain drummed hard on the roof of the car and the Burbank top began to leak. A pool of water formed on the floorboards for me to keep my feet in. It was too early in the fall for that kind of rain. I struggled into a trench coat and made a dash for the nearest drugstore and bought myself a pint of whiskey. Back in the car, I used enough of it to keep warm and interested. I was long overparked, but the cops were too busy carrying girls and blowing whistles to bother about that. In spite of the rain, or perhaps even because of it, there was business done at Geiger's. Very nice cars stopped in front, and very nice-looking people went in and out with wrapped parcels. They were not all men. He showed about 4 o'clock. A cream-colored coupe stopped in front of the store, and I caught a glimpse of the fat face and the Charlie Chan mustache as he dodged out of it and into the store. He was hatless and wore a belted green leather raincoat. I couldn't see his glass eye at that distance. A tall and very good-looking kid in a jerkin came out of the store and rode the coupe off around the corner and came back walking, his glistening black hair plastered with rain. Another hour went by. It got dark, and the rain-clouded lights of the stores were soaked up by the black street. Streetcar bells jangled crossly. At around 5:15, the tall boy in the jerkin came out of Geiger's with an umbrella and went after the cream-colored coupe. When he had it in front, Geiger came out, and the tall boy held the umbrella over Geiger's bare head. He folded it, shook it off, and handed it into the car. He dashed back into the store. I started my motor. The coupe went west on the boulevard, which forced me to make a left turn and a lot of enemies, including a motorman who stuck his head out into the rain to bawl me out. I was 2 blocks behind the coupe before I got in the groove. I hoped Geiger was on his way home. I caught sight of him 2 or 3 times and then made him turning north into Laurel Canyon Drive. Halfway up the grade, he turned left and took a curving ribbon of wet concrete, which was called Laverne Terrace. It was a narrow street with a high bank on one side and a scattering of cabin-like houses built down the slope on the other side, so that their roofs were not very much above road level. Their front windows were masked by hedges and shrubs. Sodden trees dripped all over the landscape. Geiger had his lights on, and I hadn't. I speeded up and passed him on a curve, picked a number off a house as I went by and turned at the end of the block. He had already stopped. His car lights were tilted in at the garage of a small house with a square box hedge, so arranged that it masked the front door completely. I watched him come out of the garage with his umbrella up and go in through the hedge. He didn't act as if he expected anybody to be tailing him. Light went on in the house. I drifted down to the next house above it, which seemed empty but had no signs out. I parked, aired out the convertible, had a drink from my bottle, and sat. I didn't know what I was waiting for, but something told me to wait. Another army of sluggish minutes dragged by. Two cars came up the hill and went over the crest. It seemed to be a very quiet street. At a little after six, more bright lights bobbed through the driving rain. It was pitch black by then. A car dragged to a stop in front of Geiger's house. The filaments of its lights glowed dimly and died. The door opened, and a woman got out. A small, slim woman in a vagabond hat and a transparent raincoat. She went in through the box maze. A bell rang faintly. Light through the rain. A closing door. Silence. I reached a flash out of my car pocket and went down grade and looked at the car. It was a Packard convertible, maroon or dark brown. The left window was down. I felt for the license holder and poked light at it. The registration read, Carmen Sternwood, 3765 Alta Brea Crescent, West Hollywood. I went back to my car again and sat and sat. The top dripped on my knees and my stomach burned from the whiskey. No more cars came up the hill. No lights went on in the house before which I was parked. It seemed like a nice neighborhood to have bad habits in. At 7:20, a single flash of hard white light shot out of Geiger's house, like a wave of summer lightning. As the darkness folded back on it and ate it up, a thin, tinkling scream echoed out and lost itself among the rain-drenched trees. I was out of the car and on my way before the echoes died. There was no fear in the scream. It had a sound of half-pleasurable shock, an accent of drunkenness, an overtone of pure idiocy. It was a nasty sound. It made me think of men in white and barred windows and hard, narrow cots with leather wrist and ankle straps fastened to them. The Geiger hideaway was perfectly silent again when I hit the gap in the hedge and dodged around the angle that masked the front door. There was an iron ring in a lion's mouth for a knocker. I reached for it. I had hold of it. At that exact instant, as if somebody had been waiting for the cue, three shots boomed in the house. There was a sound that might have been a long, harsh sigh, then a soft, messy thump, and then rapid footsteps in the house, going away. The door fronted on a narrow run like a footbridge over a gully that filled the gap between the house wall and the edge of the bank. There was no porch, no solid ground, no way to get around to the back. The back entrance was at the top of a flight of wooden steps that rose from the alley-like street below. I knew this because I heard a clatter of feet on the steps going down. Then I heard the sudden roar of a starting car. It faded swiftly into the distance. I thought the sound was echoed by another car, but I wasn't sure. The house in front of me was as silent as a vault. There wasn't any hurry. What was in there was in there. I straddled the fence at the side of the runway and leaned far out to the draped but unscreened French window and tried to look in at the crack where the drapes came together. I saw lamplight on a wall and one end of a bookcase. I got back on the runway and took all of it and some of the hedge and gave the front door the heavy shoulder. This was foolish. About the only part of a California house you can't put your foot through is the front door. All it did was hurt my shoulder and make me mad. I climbed over the railing again and kicked the French window in, used my hat for a glove, and pulled out most of the lower small pane of glass. I could now reach in and draw a bolt that fastened the window to the sill. The rest was easy. There was no top bolt. The catch gave. I climbed in and pulled the drapes off my face. Neither of the two people in the room paid any attention to the way I came in, although only one of them was dead. 7. It was a wide room, the whole width of the house. It had a low-beamed ceiling and brown plaster walls decked out with strips of Chinese embroidery, and Chinese and Japanese prints in grained wood frames. There were low bookshelves. There was a thick, pinkish Chinese rug in which a gopher could have spent a week without showing his nose above the nap. There were floor cushions, bits of odd silk tossed around, as if whoever lived there had to have a piece he could reach out and thumb. There was a broad, low divan of old rose tapestry. It had a wad of clothes on it, including lilac-colored silk underwear. There was a big carved lamp on a pedestal, two other standing lamps with jade-green shades and long tassels. There was a black desk with carved gargoyles at the corners, and behind it a yellow satin cushion on a polished black chair with carved arms and back. The room contained an odd assortment of odors, of which the most emphatic at the moment seemed to be the pungent aftermath of cordite and the sickish aroma of ether. On a sort of low dais at one end of the room there was a high-backed teakwood chair in which Miss Carmen Sternwood was sitting on a fringed orange shawl. She was sitting very straight, with her hands on the arms of the chair, her knees close together, her body stiffly erect in the pose of an Egyptian goddess, her chin level, her small, bright teeth shining between her parted lips. Her eyes were wide open. The dark slate color of the iris had devoured the pupil. They were mad eyes. She seemed to be unconscious, but she didn't have the pose of unconsciousness. She looked as if, in her mind, she was doing something very important and making a fine job of it. Out of her mouth came a tinny, chuckling noise which didn't change her expression or even move her lips. She was wearing a pair of long jade earrings. They were nice earrings, and it probably cost a couple of $100. She wasn't wearing anything else. She had a beautiful body, small, lithe, compact, firm, rounded. Her skin in the lamplight had the shimmering luster of a pearl. Her legs didn't quite have the raffish grace of Mrs. Regan's legs, but they were very nice. I looked her over without either embarrassment or ruddishness. As a naked girl, she was not there in that room at all. She was just a dope. To me, she was always just a dope. I stopped looking at her and looked at Geiger. He was on his back on the floor beyond the fringe of the Chinese rug in front of a thing that looked like a totem pole. It had a profile like an eagle, and its wide round eye was a camera lens. The lens was aimed at the naked girl in the chair. There was a blackened flash bulb clipped to the side of the totem pole. Geiger was wearing Chinese slippers with thick felt soles, and his legs were in black satin pajamas, and the upper part of him wore a Chinese embroidered coat, in front of which was mostly blood. His glass eye shone brightly up at me and was by far the most lifelike thing about him. At a glance, none of the three shots I heard had missed. He was very dead. The flashbulb was the sheet lightning I had seen. The crazy scream was the doped and naked girl's reaction to it. The three shots had been somebody else's idea of how the proceedings might be given a new twist. The idea of the lad who had gone down the back steps and slammed into a car and raced away. I could see merit in his point of view. A couple of fragile gold-veined glasses rested on a red lacquer tray on the end of the black desk, beside a pot-bellied flagon of brown liquid. I took the stopper out and sniffed at it. It smelled of ether and something else, possibly laudanum. I had never tried the mixture, but it seemed to go pretty well with the Geiger menage. I listened to the rain hitting the roof and the north windows. Beyond was no other sound, no cars, no siren, just the rain beating. I went over to the divan and peeled off my trench coat and pawed through the girl's clothes. There was a pale green rough wool dress of the pull-on type with half sleeves. I thought I might be able to handle it. I decided to pass up her underclothes, not from feelings of delicacy, but because I couldn't see myself putting her pants on and snapping her brassiere. I took the dress over to the teak chair on the dais. Miss Sternwood smelled of ether also, at a distance of several feet. The tinny chuckling noise was still coming from her, and a little froth oozed down her chin. I slapped her face. She blinked and stopped chuckling. I slapped her again. "Come on," I said brightly. "Let's be nice. Let's get dressed." She peered at me, her slaty eyes as empty as holes in a mask.
"Gutterell,"
she said. I slapped her around a little more. She didn't mind the slaps. They didn't bring her out of it. I set to work with the dress. She didn't mind that either. She let me hold her arms up, and she spread her fingers out wide, as if that was cute. I got her hands through the sleeves, pulled the dress down over her back, and stood her up. She fell into my arms, giggling. I set her back in the chair and got her stockings and shoes on her. "Let's take a little walk," I said. "Let's take a nice little walk." We took a little walk. Part of the time her earrings banged against my chest, and part of the time we did the splits in unison, like adagio dancers. We walked over to Geiger's body and back. I had her look at him. She thought he was cute. She giggled and tried to tell me so, but she just bubbled. I walked her over to the divan and spread her out on it. She hiccuped twice, giggled.